Thank you. Be seated. Justice O'Neill is recused from this case.
This case concerns regulation of the high-energy electric transmission grid that covers most of the state. I've brought with me a diagram of that grid in the event of discussion of the underlying facts with the help of the court. The question presented today is really a rather straightforward matter of statutory construction. At issue is whether the Public Utility Commission has statutory authority to adopt a rule establishing a method for determining the rates that electric utilities will charge and pay each other to move power over that grid. Nothing in that rule actually establishes or sets those rates, but the rule does contemplate that the rates will be set in contested case proceedings. The Court of Appeals focused on that point and validated the rule on a single ground, holding that the Commission has no authority to set rates for transmission service, and instead read the statute to direct the Commission to mimic the federal approach to regulating transmission service, which approach the lower court interpreted to consign the Commission to the role of an arbiter of disputes over privately negotiated contracts. I will address the first point, the lower court's misreading of the Commission's statutory authority. Ms. Sterling will address the second, the court's misunderstanding of the federal model. Perhaps the most telling thing about the opinion published below is that neither respondent defends its central holding. Both briefs admit that it is wrong on that point. Both briefs admit that the Commission now has, and has always had, statutory authority to set rates for wholesale transmission service for utilities under its jurisdiction.
But not this way, they say.
Not statewide. Always utility specific, always in contested case hearings.
The rates are set in contested cases.
And in only two cases that you or the PUC can even come up with, the one LCRA case and the other case.
Well, the underlying question is not the method by which the court can exercise its authority. But the lower court said.
You mean the PUC?
The commission. The lower court held the Commission has no statutory authority at all to set rates for wholesale transmission service. And all it could do is set rates for retail rates. And the only thing that Chapter 35 did was authorize the Commission to act as an arbiter of private disputes over individually negotiated transmission service.
But even if the CA said that, and assuming it was wrong, how does the PUC have historic authority to set statewide rates?
Well, first of all, the rule does not set statewide rate. The rule sets
statewide.
Well,
if it says you can only charge this much, and you know what A is and you know what B is, doesn't it set the rate?
It sets a statewide methodology. And actually, the historical approach of this court has been that statewide rules of general applicability are actually preferred. They can be uniformly applied, as indicated in the cases cited in our briefs. The rates were actually set in individual contested case proceedings for each transmission service provider using the formula, which does apply statewide. Now, none of the respondents are complaining about what they are allowed to charge for transmission service.
Now, let me...
They are complaining about what they have to pay as customers of transmission service provided by
others. Said this several times that the commission has always had the authority to set rates in a contested proceeding. And now let me ask a couple questions. South Texas Electric Cooperative explicitly states this, and I glean it from the commission's brief, but it's not entirely clear to me. The authority to set rates is Chapter 36. Is that right?
Well, it depends upon whether or not you agree with the lower court that magic words are needed when that is the question of the agency's authority.
Well, now,
the lower court's first.
Well, your argument has never been that 35 is a separate grant of rate authority. Your argument has always been that 36 is the rate making authority of the PUC, and that 35 simply carved out what used to be bundled, which was transmission services, and subjected transmission services rate assessment against municipal utility.
That's not quite right, Your Honor.
So you
we argue that actually they both authorized the commission to adopt this rule.
Okay. So let me finish. So you really do agree that the rule, your rate making that you have done, is pursuant to what you believe to be the authority of 35, and that 36 really is no longer a consideration here. We are looking solely at 35.
No, Your Honor, the reasoning dissects into two steps. The first is, it presents this question. Does an agency's statutory authority to adopt and rule setting the method for rate making, is that a special case of statutory construction requiring magic words in which the normal rules of statutory construction do not apply? Because the traditional interpretation of an agency's statutory authority has at least three principles the lower court refused to apply. The first is that the determinative factor is whether the rule...
I'm sorry, you're getting ahead of me, Mr. Morgan.
Okay, that's the first question.
I'm not asking... What standard gets applied to reading 35 and where the grants are. I'm trying to understand what your position is about which of these statutes, which of these provisions set the rate-making authority.
All right, Your Honor.
You argue that 35 has to be read in conjunction with 36. The South Texas Electric Cooperative says explicitly that 36 is where the rate-making authority comes in. Both of you argue all 35 did is subject the municipally owned power companies to the rate-making authority of the PUC and carves out the transmission services that used to be bundled under 36 and carved them out and identified them as the thing over which the rate-making authority would be exercised.
Right. I'm not explaining myself clearly enough, Your Honor. The first question is whether this is a special case of statutory construction. If it is not, and the normal rules of statutory construction apply, then the language that's in Chapter 35 right now is enough. If the lower court was right, and it is a special case requiring magic words, it's in 36.
I'm not articulating very well, Ben. I'm not articulating very well. Is it your position that 35 grants rate-making authority to the PUC? In the absence of that, does the PUC have rate-making authority for the wholesale transmission of services?
I think my answer is yes. Chapter 35, under the traditional rules...
So you're arguing the alternative. If we determine that you do have to have a special authority for 35, then you fall back to 36.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Under the traditional rules of statutory construction, the language the legislature put in Chapter 35 in 1995 is enough. That chapter that directs the commission to implement the first step in deregulating the electric utility business by ensuring that there was competition in the wholesale market by preventing the use of monopoly control of transmission service.
Don't those traditional rules of statutory interpretation allow us to look at the language used in other provisions and compare and contrast? My problem, I think you've kind of already touched upon this, but maybe you can clarify it again, and that is the difference in language used in Section 35006A and Section 36001. Basically, I'm talking about the problem pointed out by the Court of Appeals in footnote 16.
I don't have my recollection of what that language is in that book.
Well, in 35006A, it says the Commission shall adopt rules relating to wholesale transmission service rates and access. And then in 36, the regulatory authority may establish and regulate rates of an electric utility and may adopt rules for determining, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, it seems like what you want to achieve is clearly set out in Section 36, but not in 35.
Well, under the traditional rules, as I was indicating in Justice Enoch, our position is on the traditional rules of statutory construction of an agency's authority. The phrasing in Chapter 35, which does, as you pointed out, Your Honor, they say, direct the Commission to adopt rules relating to wholesale transmission service rates and access. It described those rules as transmission pricing and access rules. It directed all utilities to file tariffs implementing such rules, and it contemplated that the Commission would review those.
But here's my point, applying traditional and standard rules of statutory interpretation. The legislature was clear in Section 36 how to achieve what it is that you want to have achieved. However, when they had the same opportunity to be that equally clear in Section 35, they didn't say the same thing in Section 35 that you want to achieve.
Well, that presents the second question, then, the second part of this dissected approach, and that is whether or not the authorizing language the legislature has to repeat in each chapter of the statute. The traditional rules, it gets read as a whole. In the Chapter 36, it authorizes the commission to set rates for anything that a public utility does. Chapter 35 tells the commission what to do with that authority when the legislature sought to deregulate wholesale transmission, wholesale pricing. And it said for this purpose, a public utility includes municipally owned utilities. Now,
okay, let me add on that then. Let's go back to 36. Mm-hmm. Again, I must not understand your position. The rate making that PUC is doing here is done according to the terms of 36. Just 35 makes it applicable to municipal, it already applies to the investor-owned utilities. 35 just now makes it applicable to, according to your view, applicable to municipally owned and cooperatives.
Well, that's actually a fallback position, but...
Well, I understand it, but you just again said, you look at 36 because that's the general grant, and then you look to 35 because there's a specific activity that's occurring here. So let's go to 36. Under Chapter 36, can the PUC require utility customers to pay subsidies to another utility customer through the rate-making process? Does 36 permit in the rate-making process the PUC to pass through a, let's say, an emergency fund for, let's use an example that comes out of Rio Grande Utility. The Rio Grande Utility has some particular concerns because of the communities it serves that there may be some brownouts or something. They're a part of the grid. Can the PUC impose through the rate making under Chapter 36 a surcharge to be passed along to the customers for that emergency fund to be used to support electric service to another part of the state?
I don't believe so. That's not what this rule does.
Is it limited? Well, let's. I want to inquire about that. Is it 36's rate making is limited to assuring that the costs that are being passed on by the utility to their customers are reasonable, should be recouped, and a reasonable return on the investments, I guess. I mean, there's some rules on
right.
What is allowed in the rate, and this is what they're doing.
That's right. What this rule does, what, and
well,
I like
want
to
talk about 36. Right. Now, the other question is, under Rule 36, you mentioned contested case hearings in your opening and throughout. Does Rule 36 permit the PUC, there are tariffs that are filed. There can be contests over the tariffs. Does the PUC have the authority to preset the rate that utilities across, in general across the state? Can PUC sit in Austin and say, we have determined that the average cost throughout the state to provide electricity is X. You had, 10% return or 14% return on top of those costs. So we now will set the rate that a utility in Texas can charge their consumers to provide electricity. Could they preset that as to each utility across the state?
I doubt it, because it's my understanding that the costs have to be assessed per utility, and the rates that that utility charges determined by its individual costs.
Let's go to your argument then that Chapter 35 is a separate grant of rate-making authority. If it's a separate grant of rate-making authority, you're relying on the language of they can make rules relating to setting rates.
Well, that's part of it. There are other language that makes reference to pricing rules and so forth.
According to the PUC's argument, that language, rules relating to setting rates, permits them not only to pass through subsidies based on some sort of formula of peak load usage of a grid, but also permits them to preset a uniform statewide rate.
That's not true, on either point.
What is in Chapter 35 that permits a postage stamp rate charge and also permits the rate to be set outside the usual case-specific contest regarding recovery of the costs of the utility from their consumers.
There's nothing in the statute, at least the chapter at issue here, that specifies the methodology that the court, that the commission is to use in its rate-making function. I don't recall the second part of your question.
Well, we established in 36 that there are limits on their rate-making authority for the PUC. In 35, I accept you say that 35 gives a separate grant for rate-making authority, and my question is, from that language, are we to assume that the PUC is no longer limited in its rate-making authority as it is otherwise limited under Chapter 36? I guess that's my question.
Well, it's limited by the other provisions of Chapter 35, and except to that extent, I would say no, it's not. But there is no subsidy here. I keep hearing this word, and it's completely an inaccurate description of how their costs may have increased, their expenses have increased, simply because they now have to pay more for access to this grid than they were paying before. That's just the same as increasing the cost of coal. That's just an expense, or paper clips, or trucking, or anything else. It's just an increase in their expenses. That's not a subsidy.
If your interpretation of these statutes is correct, what did the legislature gain with its 1999 amendments?
What it gained was it told the commission to adopt 100% the methodology that these respondents continue to insist cannot be legally adopted at all, consistent with the other provisions of the statute.
Well, they're not complaining about 1999, at least not.
No, they're not. They're not. But the point is that the legislature in 1999 said, you're using 70% of a postage stamp here for this system. We want you to use that 100% and drop this other 30%. Use it 100%. And incidentally, the legislature did nothing to change the language that already authorized the commission to set rates, and it did nothing to change the language in any of the three provisions that the respondents still insist cannot be reconciled with that approach.
So are you saying that if we rule against you, we would be undermining the intent of the most recent amendments?
I think there's no question, Your Honor.
But does that mean the same thing, that we're overruling the intent of the legislature when it passed this act in 1995?
Yes, I believe it
does. There's a lot of cases that say when they make these kind of changes, it presumes that it's changing the law because they added something to it. What's your answer to that?
Well, my answer to that is the one of, at least one of the briefs indicated by the Texas New Mexico Power in the legislative history here, from March of 1996, when this rule was adopted, in 1996 and 97, the legislature received three separate reports describing the methodology that the commission was using, and they did nothing to change its authority. And in 99, they looked at this and said, well, we kind of like this postage stamp you're using. We want you to use that 100%. But they didn't change the existing language that authorized the commission to set rates.
So your argument would be then, this was the interpretation that the PUC put on its authority to set rates for wholesale transmission services, that the legislature acquiesced in that when it got the reports, and finally in 99 ratified the acquiescence by saying not only do we like 70%, but we want you to do it 100%. Is that your argument?
We think that's very illuminating what the legislature thought the statute meant.
Thank you.
I believe I've used up all of Ms. Sterling's time.
She'll have her chance. How much time do we have left for the petitioners?
He's used 18 minutes. 18 minutes and a lot.
But how much time did they reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes for rebuttal.
Does anybody want to hear from Ms. Sterling now?
What can you do in 2 minutes?
Give her 5 minutes.
Talk fast, I guess.
We'll give you 5 minutes, but we'll probably take it all up in questions.
That's fine, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by answering some of the questions that have been raised. The rules that were adopted do not set any rates. All they do is say this is the methodology. Once we find out the numbers in a rate case,
well, that can hardly be taken seriously if you say this is the formula and then you know all of the factors, don't you know the answer?
Well,
can the commission say we're not setting rates when you've got to do it this way, plug in your pieces, and there's the answer?
I think you might just as well say, well, the statute already tells us how to set rates in any case, because it says you've got to figure out what your investment, that it's the return on your investment plus the expenses. I mean, that's a little bit of a methodology. This is a more intense methodology, but it's telling you what you do with the numbers. The rate cases come up with the precise numbers.
And then what is the arbitration for?
The arbitration was an option that could be used the way that the
commission... What are they going to argue about? The methodology or the numbers that get put into the methodology?
The arbitration is once you've already got the tariff on file and you're using it.
It's preset by the rule, isn't it? The amount that will be charged as an access fee is preset by the rule. So how can there be a disagreement among the parties to the contract as to what they're supposed to pay?
Well, let me go back. The amount isn't set by the rule. The rule just says you go through this methodology, you put these numbers in, and once you finish, the rule doesn't tell you which numbers. The rule says go have a case, figure out what the numbers are, and this is what you do with them to come out with a rate in the contested case proceedings. But and I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What was the rest of...
What would there be to arbitrate?
What there would be to arbitrate? We cited, the PUC cited in their case, an AT&T case, which was an example of where there was there had been a rate case, a rate had been set, and the tariff had been filed and approved, and after that, parties came in and said, I think you're misinterpreting this tariff. I think it means something else. I think... you owe us a different rate, or we have to pay at a different rate. And there was a dispute about that. What the commission did in its rules is to say those kind of things can be done by dispute. And furthermore, once we've set your rates, if you want to change your rates...
But how do the parties agree? I'm having a hard time. The PUC is saying what's going to be paid for the access fee. All that's being discussed is we take this calculation based on all the usages of all these utilities and we divide it by a certain factor, and that comes up what your assessment's going to be for participating in this grid. That is what you're going to be charged. So that charge gets passed through to the customer. The customer says, I disagree with that charge. There's nothing in their arbitration that can change that charge, is there?
The customer who's important here is the transmission customer, which would be either probably another utility or so. So it's not like passed through in the charge. It is the charge to that other utility who's using the transmission services.
Well, is there any dispute about ERCOT total transmission charges? No, not any dispute about that, is there?
In this case, Your Honor?
Yes.
Well,
in any case. I mean, aren't they whatever they are?
What they are, they're made up of coming up with what is each transmission.
But I mean, there's not going to be any litigation over that, is there? I mean, Isn't that number, don't we know what that number is?
No, Your Honor, we don't necessarily know what it is. We have this transmission piece that's been separated out from the rest of the utility, and we have to figure out for this transmission piece, just like we would in any rate case, how much did you invest in transmission? What rate of return should you earn on transmission? What are your proper expenses? Are they reasonable? Are you spending too much? All of those questions you have in any rate case, you would have in the contested cases that the rule provides for, where you come up with the numbers.
We're talking about the postage stamp. The postage stamp says regardless of all of that, there's going to be a one charge.
The numbers that go into the postage stamp come out of that kind of case.
I don't see how you can relitigate in case after case after case what the total ERCOT numbers are that you're going to take this utility's percentage of to decide what is that utility's charge is for using the system. I don't see how you're going to relitigate in one case, no, it really wasn't that total, it was really enough.
What you're likely
the peak load of the ERCOT is the peak load, isn't it? You can't, are you going to... You're going to, one utility has a contested case, and they prove that the peak load is really only this much. And then another utility has a case, and they prove that the peak load is this much.
Your Honor, the peak load is not going to change. What's going to change is the numbers that come out. The peak load is, you take the rule says you take the peak load, and then you take how much everybody used out of that peak load, but you take that percentage.
And none of those are in dispute.
Well, they weren't even decided in this case. They were decided in another case. But there hasn't been a dispute about that.
Right.
The thing, though, is you apply that percentage to a number that was determined in a case where you had to figure out what's the investment, what's the rate of return, what are your expenses, were they reasonable, was it prudent for you to have done these things, all those kinds of issues that are the typical issues you have in any rate case.
And that's the assessment that, say, San Antonio will now have to pay for access to the grid is a function of what its costs are for its materials.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Lang, I'm sorry, you've got a red light here, and maybe we ought to try it on rebuttal, but one of the critical points that's been raised by the respondents was the fact, and the Court of Appeals, that there's no reason for arbitration under Chapter 35 if the PUC is going to preset these rates. There's no purpose for the parties to get together and agree that they'll pay something else if the PUC is going to dictate what they're going to have to pay. And that's been a point that was raised by the Court of Appeals. That's been a point that's been raised here by the respondents. And what's been missing in the reply is what you're telling us right now, that, wait a minute, the assessment isn't set by the PUC, it's not preset, it's done by contested case hearings after there's been a full hearing, and the assessment is based on each particular utility's own costs that are being passed through to its own customers. And I don't understand the postage stamp. The argument postage stamp was those costs were never, the reason you used a postage stamp is so that you wouldn't be having to factor in all of the costs of any individual utility. And they were all going to pay just one fee regardless of the cost of transmission.
And if I can go through just a couple of minutes, hopefully a minute, I think I may be able to clear some of this up. Before the rule, you had vertically integrated utilities where one company owned all its own generation. It owns transmission to get generation to its retail customers. One of the things the rule did that isn't disputed and that, in fact, everybody agrees was proper was to do what they called functional unbundling, which is to say you have to take these and treat them like they're different companies, because the whole problem is that you're trying to sell generation and you own transmission, and so you're messing up the rates that way. When you separate them into separate companies, then this company, the one that's providing the retail service, has to buy transmission service from this one. It also has to buy transmission service from every other company in the grid, because the way the grid works, when power is put in, it goes everywhere. It doesn't just go on a preset line. Electricity doesn't work that way. So the rule says that these rates are going to be paid by everybody. And one of the things the rule had to decide was, well, how much do you pay here? Because they weren't treated as special companies, separate companies before. They were all one. So once you separate them, you have to figure out how much do you pay. Well, the rule sets up a procedure so that the same rate is charged by this transmission company to this retail company and every other transmission customer in ERCOT. The same rate. But this retail company is not just paying this transmission company, it's paying every transmission company in the state.
We're taking up a lot of time, but you said the PUC wants to make sure that the transmission company charges the same rate across the grid. What is there to be arbitrated over that rate by the parties to a particular contract using that transmission?
The question is, what is that rate, that particular rate? And that's based on...
But the parties can't arbitrate that rate, no, because the PUC sets the rate.
The parties can arbitrate things like, oh, there's a provision in here for losses, what are we going to do about that? Did I really have spot sales? I mean, there are more intricacies to the rule than what we have talked about, what we focused on here. And certainly they can arbitrate that. And the rule...
You're saying there are some other charges that the transmission company can charge them other than the access fee
And that's what the arbitration provision is for.
Well, but the arbitration provision in the rule in 2367M says that if this transmission company says, I have to change, my costs have gone up, and I want to change the rates, that before it files a new rate case, it's supposed to go and arbitrate with the, or it's supposed to get to its customers and talk to its customers about wanting to change that rate. As I said, that's in 2367 of the M of the rule, which is in our reply brief.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Ma'am, we're ready for your argument from Ms. Palmer.
Okay, this court, Mr. Brad Wacker and Mr. Pete Shankin will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Wacker will open for the first 2 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Brad Wagner, and I'm here representing the City Public Service Board of San Antonio, a municipally owned utility. I am going to speak to the statutory construction issues here, and Mr. Shankin is going to speak to the illegal subsidy that's been created by this ruling. Let me abandon my outline and try to come up immediately to you, Justin, and try to address your question of this Chapter 36 and 35 jurisdiction, because that is the background that we all need to understand, the starting point. And that is the distinction that is both historical and current of the PUC's regulation of, and if I'm being shorthanded, the MOUs and IOUs. The Chapter 36 jurisdiction was and is the historical jurisdiction that PUC's had since 1975 when it was created. Over IOUs, you have to look at the definition there in 36 because it excludes municipals. And clearly, under Chapter 36, the PUC has had and continues to have broad rate-making jurisdiction over IOUs, including the power to set rates for wholesale transmission. Nobody has questioned that. Not us. But Chapter 36 jurisdiction has never included municipals. We are not subject to that broad regulation. Our cities regulate our rates. The first time, other than some limited appellate jurisdiction, the very first time that the PUC got any kind of jurisdiction over the municipals were the 95 PURA amendments on wholesale transmission. But that jurisdiction was not rate-making jurisdiction. Now, the PUC's rule, as you've heard some of the discussion, goes up and picks up all these numbers, aggregates it. It sets my municipal rates and aggregates them. Now, to do that, they've got to have that rate-making power. It can't come from Chapter 36. That says we specifically exclude municipals from there. So we come over, and that's why the Court of Appeals focuses on Chapter 35, which is the 2056 and 2057, the PURA 95 amendment. So we're going to look right there. This is the logical progression we must have to follow this argument through. And what is the best argument that the petitioners have come up with? It is language that says the PUC has the power to make rules, quote, relating to rates.
Let me ask you this. In 35.004C, it says that if the electric utility, this is municipal, provides service, transmission service to a third party, the commission shall ensure that it recovers its reasonable costs. How do you do that if you don't have rate-making jurisdiction?
Okay, and here's the process, and let me explain to you what the fair reading of the statute did. And it's based in part on the federal model, so I might as well get there and jump ahead. What it did, the federal model set up where the utilities went in and FERC pulled apart the transmission costs and said, you put some of these costs in this bucket and you set up your rates. So it was left, and if you read all of 2057 and you read what the utilities are supposed to do, the PUC could come in and say, put these costs in this bucket, do this, do that, then you, transmission utility, set up your rate and you file it as a tariff. Okay? And then 205.6 and 7 says those rates must be reasonable. And so, and it gives the PUC the power to judge reasonableness, which under Deffenbach we know is not the same as the power to set a rate. And we know under your opinion in Phillips versus Bieber about a year ago, and I'm sorry Justice O'Neill's not here, she wrote that opinion, we know that the legislature is also deemed to know of the prior court precedent in drafting its language of 205.6 and 205.7. And that would include Deffenbach, which says when I give you the power to judge the reasonableness, that doesn't mean I'm giving you the power to judge and set a rate. All you can say is yes or no.
It says ensure.
Ensure that the rates are reasonable.
Reasonable cost for providing transmission services.
And that is actually a protection for the utility to make sure that it doesn't under-recover.
But how do they go about insuring it?
Excuse me?
How do they go about insuring it?
How do they go about insuring it under the statutory scheme?
Right.
The rate would be established and calculated by each utility. And it might say, for example, I'm going to take my transmission costs and I'm going to say...
So that's the utilities insuring it, not PUC.
And if you read the statute under 205.6, the utility in the first instance, Your Honor, does make that determination. It doesn't say that the commission goes in and does that. And it says you, utility, then file that 5 cents.
But if that's inadequate, then how does the commission ensure that it must be a different rate so that the utility will recover its reasonable cost?
Well, the utility in the first instance, I'm going to submit to Your Honor, is not going to file a deficient.
But my question is the same one Judge Abbott asked. That's the utility standpoint. How does the commission, as it's directed by the legislature, how does it ensure?
It could go in and say your rates are not reasonable.
Suicide.
Go back. Well, they have an opportunity to review a tariff when it's filed, and they could go in and look
say,
at the tariff.
That's not it. Keep coming, then we'll tell you when it's a reasonable.
Well, they could come in and say you have used the wrong kind of rate analysis to come up with your rate of return, for example. But you're assuming again, and again, I need to get to a point here. Where does the commission get the power to set a rate in these 95 amendments? And you're trying to focus on the words ensure, and I appreciate that. But that doesn't say you shall go in and fix and establish the rates. As you pointed out, Justice Abbott, in footnote 16, the legislature knows how to do that. They've known how to do it for 60 years, since the Humble Oil case. The Humble Oil case is on all fours here. And it says rate-making jurisdiction, it says two things. It cannot be inferred. Cannot be inferred. Now take any of the language you're reading me or that we have relating to rates and tell me, does it say shall fix or establish or shall regulate the rates? It doesn't say that. The only way you can find it is to infer it.
The 99 changes indicate that the legislature intended the PUC to make rates.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If you look at 35.004, the new long sentence, as I call it, it says you shall price them, and it literally reads the formula they want to use. Then if you go back to section 40.004, it says the Public Utility Commission shall have the power to regulate rates.
Why does
and if they had to say that, and if you have to presume they meant to change something.
Why?
And they did.
Why? Why wouldn't you presume that they really thought what they'd done in 95 was fine? A dispute arose between postage stamp approach or some other approach, and they decided this one.
Well, I think the presumption works the other way, Your Honor. That is to say, when you enact something, you are presumed to be making a change. And so I think the way the operation of the presumption works here is when they do something and add some new language, it's presumed to be a change, not trying to really state the same thing I stated back in 95.
Have there been challenges to the 99 amendments?
Are there?
Have there been?
No, in terms of the same challenges we're making here, they are not. I think one of the other points, Your Honor, I need to make very quickly is the 99 legislature can't come back, in my opinion, and tell us what the 95 legislature meant. I don't think we can do that. I don't think that's ever been a rule of statutory construction. Certainly your legislative acceptance doctrine, we don't go back and retroactively tell one legislature, tell another legislature what you meant.
What about petitioner's contention, and that is that the 99 amendment would, in some respects, be for naught if we construe this particular provision in your favor?
That is not at all true, Your Honor. We have a locked-in period here of about 2 years and 8 months. Under the 99, Senate Bill 7, they have new statutory authority, which we believe, and they're not even contesting, grants them the right, for the first time, to set a municipally owned utility rate and to set it using the statewide aggregation subsidy.
Let me repeat that for clarification of my understanding. That is that the authority the legislature vested in the PUC in 99 is authorized with regard to municipalities under a 97 amendment. Is that what you just said?
No, not under a 97 amendment. I'm sorry.
What is the
Senate Bill 7? I'm sorry.
What's the authorizing legislation that allows the PUC to set rates for municipalities?
Now. Again, I keep saying rates. I mean wholesale transmission rates.
Exactly.
It is Section 40.004, which we've cited in our brief, which talks about the PUC, and it says, "Parens one little I." Shall have the power to, parens one lie, and it says to regulate the rights of municipals. It's that simple. It's straightforward.
Why do we have to presume, though, that the legislature may say, well, it's not as clear as it could have been in 95 what we wrote, so we're going to use different language in 99. Why do we have to presume that they meant something different rather than a clarification?
I'm talking to the large animal here. I'm not going to tell you you can't presume it. I don't think that is an appropriate way to approach a statutory construction. But even if you want to do that, Your Honor, what happens in this instance, we have the Humble Oil case that has been here for 60 years that says you must, to grant rate-making power, you must grant it in language that is free from doubt and admits of no other reasonable construction. The minute you tell me it is ambiguous, I say the PUC and the petitioners have lost. We don't grant rate making.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
I was just trying to get some time for
my attention. I'm sorry. I didn't see you pretty much.
May it please the court. The difference between what happened in 99 and what happened in 96 is that in 99, the legislature adopted a subsidy. The legislature's power to adopt subsidy requirements.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
On the structure of this entire rate system, do I understand the postage stamp methodology basically says regardless of the distance that you're buying this electricity from, how far it comes to you, this methodology makes that charge the same statewide. Is that correct?
Well, it averages out everybody's cost statewide. It takes my client, Houston Lighting and Power, over here, and Rio Grande Electric Co-op over here, and says we're going to pretend that all of your costs are in one big pot and spread them out based on your load ratio.
Right,
even though you haven't asked for anything.
Whatever that is the facet of the final transmission rate. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. The dictated formula, that's the formula.
And that's what you're complaining about.
Yes, sir. And I'm addressing the part that addresses the substance, the subsidy, rather than how it's set.
Is it true, then, that before the actual rate is set, that the utilities involved put together their package of what's going to be stacked on top of this subsidy, you call it, and they come to the PUC and say, here's the rate we want because it includes the postage stamp thing, plus our cost, et cetera, and expenses. And this is the rate we want. So that it, there's parts to all of this before you finally get to the rate that's ultimately charged. Is that right?
If I'm understanding the question right, no. My answer would be no. Okay. It's not added on to the postal standard.
It's part of it?
It's part of it. What the PUC said in the order adopting the rule is, under a statewide postage stamp pricing method, or a hybrid method, mm-hmm. which is what they adopted that mm-hmm. includes it, each utility would pay a facilities charge, this access fee, that includes costs of other utilities' transmission operations. Includes the cost of other utilities' transmission operations, like Rio Grande. So to do that, the PUC says, here's the formula, and then we have to add up everybody's cost of transmission operations and put them in the pot and crank it through the formula.
But that figure doesn't include return on capital investment.
It does.
It does, too?
It does. It's all of
it. Because it's been unbundled. Is that right?
That's right, and I need to talk briefly about that. Unbundling, Ms. Sterling talked about it as though the legislation in 95 had been at three different companies. It did not. It said we're going to separate the costs out.
Of each company's three parts.
Of its transmission, so that we can enforce the statute that said we will ensure, the commission will ensure that the costs of the transmission service are recovered from whoever is requesting the transmission service. To do that, we need to make sure each utility has gone through, their accountants have gone through and separated out those transmission costs from those other ones. So that if there's a dispute, is your transmission rate properly reflecting your cost of transmission service to the party requesting it, no more, no less, we can look at it and see. Yeah, by your cost.
What do they do?
I'm sorry.
And what if it's not? What do they do?
And
more importantly, what statutory authority authorizes them to do whatever they do?
Depends on whether you're an investor-owned utility or a municipally-owned utility. If you're an investor-owned utility, then under the Chapter 30 includes the cost of other utilities' transmission operations, might be a grant. So to do that, the PC says, here's the formula, and then we have to add up everybody's cost of transmission operations and put them in the pot.
That figure doesn't include return on capital investment.
It does too?
Only because it's been unbundled, is that right?
That's right, and I need to talk briefly about that. Unbundling, Ms. Sterling talked about it, so the legislation in 95 had three different companies. It did not. It said we're going to separate the cost out.
Of each company's three parts.
Of its transmission, so that we can enforce the statute that said we will ensure, the commission will ensure that the costs of the transmission service are recovered from whoever is requesting the transmission service. To do that, we need to make sure each utility has gone through, their accounts have gone through and separated out those transmission costs from those others. So that if there's a dispute, is your transmission rate properly reflecting the cost of transmission service to the party requesting it, no more, no less, we can look at it and see. Yeah. Driver costs.
What do they do?
I'm sorry.
And what if it's not? What do they do? And more importantly, what statutory authority authorizes them to do everything?
It depends on whether you're an investor-owned utility or a municipally-owned utility. If you're an investor-owned utility, then under the Chapter 36 procedures, which allow tested case on complaint or on the commission's own motion, the commission says your rate doesn't meet your cost. If you're too high or too low, we're going to have a hearing to correct it. If you're an MOU, under a whole set of other precedents about rate-making, and rate regulation and tariff filing. It's a wrong rock to it. You lost the wrong rock. Here's why. You told us the consultant to test the case. The test the case would be on the complaint saying it's too much, loading too much, the city is loading too much into its transition costs. They'll find out that being said too much. Then you've got to come back with a new rate. So that looks inefficient, why don't you cut the chase and have the PUC just go ahead and dictate the municipal rate? That, I assume, is what was intended to be left.
So the authority they have is the authority to reject the proposed rate.
To reject it on an evidentiary hearing in which we say, and here's what's wrong with it, which gives you some pretty strong facts.
Do you have your fingertips to the statute that provides that authority? Do you have your fingertips to the statute that provides that authority?
Or the MOU, it would be a reading of the provision cited by Justice Sullivan, at least, that said the commission shall ensure, plus the generic statements under both the APA and the PURA, that unless otherwise provided, please, that's the case.
Okay. When you first got up, you started making a point that it didn't
test. Well, I'm not sure whether it's better to try to finish it or to answer a set of questions, but if that was a decision to remove, it might be
the next question, but I'm sure it'll be interrupted.
Okay.
Let me ask you. you have said it too long.
I mean, it's the same clause.
Okay, thank you.
You make a big distinction between a tariff, where he's the commander and sit there and say, tariff unlimited us, go back and do it over again. And they play a role in it. How is that functionally different than if you, the PUC just on its own motion says, okay, you said, all y'all come on in here and we're going to now have a contested hearing on what tariffs you all plan on filing, and we'll just go ahead and set the rate. What, I mean, I understand the specific authority to set the rate, but they do have the authority to look at the tariffs and determine whether the tariff's reasonable, which seems to mirror a lot of what they're obviously doing right here. So, what
the key difference is if the utility is required to file a tariff, and the PUC gets to look at the tariff and see if it is statutory standards. But the PUC doesn't get to tell the utility on the front end, you can have any price you want as long as it's in one form of inventory. You can have any color you want as long as it's black. As long as the PUC can't do that, the utility sits down and looks at and says, here's how I think the transmission price for my transmission facility, not the operations, my transmission facility, should be set and filed. You say, well, what difference does that make? The difference it makes is there are, in fact, multiple ways of doing this, which are lots of good ways of doing it. A regional postage stamp, which is what they came up with and caused the complaints here, is certainly not the only way. The Texas regional postage stamp,
96 ordered by the PUC, 99 by the legislature, is the only involuntary regional postage stamp in the world. There are no others in which fueling utilities have been ordered to pool their costs against their will, not on a trade, and spread them back out on this way. If it were not for this rule, my client would be free to propose what's called a license plate rate in its tariff. It's called the local area rate in its rulemaking. The PUC itself, in the order it adopted, said that the local area rate meets the statutory criteria of the 95 statute. Consistent with the statute in terms of their criteria. We could have done something that would have been lawful, that would have met Augusta Bowen, the statutory standards which you called attention, ensure that the cost of the transmission service are recovered from the transmission requesting customer. Which the FERC has consistently said is fine and plenty good enough for open bolt rail transmission access. Doesn't prevent people from having good access. And where there still would have been an opportunity at OPRA or someone else thought that our tariff 11 was enough to complain about it, and we can't fight about it, we had that fight.
Or what they?
They would have had to come in and say, we didn't satisfy statutory standards.
We did.
Which is, ensure that the cost of transmission service are recovered from the party that's affecting the transmission service.
And what they're saying is too high. The X 34, 35.04C has been
But they would not be charged according to the tariffs of San Antonio to file in the commission of having to decide whether the penalty of law.
I have a question that's helpful. Where do names like postage stamp and license plate come from? And how do they get this currency that they use for the statute?
Well, it's a market effort. And it's one of the real, not a real question, because it's one of the real problems on our side of the state. The biggest problem we've got, everybody hears the word postage stamp and says, great, postage stamp is really simple, easy kind. Yeah, but that's the time to say postal corporation is one corporation. And the cost of delivering the mail are on the front end when you put it in the zip code, on the back end when you handle it, there should be addresses. The distance makes no difference. That's not true for the transmission of electricity. We are laboring under an unfair label that's been used for marketing purposes, postage stamp. And though we are laboring under it because there are utility-specific postage stamps.
Because again,
we're
dealing with the cost of other utilities transmission operations behind the frame. So to do that, the PUC says, here's the formula, and then we have to add up everybody's cost of transmission operations and put them in line.
That figure doesn't include return on capital investment.
That's it.
Because it's
unbundled.
Is that right? That's right. I'm sure I'm not going to vote.